Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
Reluctantly. And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the brand spanking new second remake of the 1974 slasher flick Black Christmas. You will be forgiven for having forgotten that a remake of the film was released in 2006.
I had forgotten that, actually.
Yeah, because it was thoroughly unremarkable.
I think that I conflated that movie with the remake of When a Stranger Calls that came out around that time.
Yeah, I think that was also 2006, certainly mid to late aughts. But anyway, like the remake of When a Stranger Calls, the 2006 Black Christmas is regarded as not being very good.
Yeah, just not even a blip on the radar.
Yeah, just kind of there and gone, like so many PG-13 horror flicks. Or indeed any horror flicks. But that's not the movie we're talking about. We're talking about the 2019 version of Black Christmas. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the original, the basic premise is that there's a murderer killing girls in a sorority house, pretty much. Pretty straightforward, as one might expect from a horror film from the 70s, because that predates all of the tropes and stereotypes being tropes and stereotypes.
Yeah,
so it doesn't have to be very complicated.
It's sort of a proto-slasher movie insofar as it precedes Halloween by a couple years, and therefore a bunch of the rules had not yet been codified.
Yeah.
The killer doesn't wear a mask, for example. He's also kind of your standard 1970s phone pervert, I guess.
Sure.
Like, you know, yeah. So it taps into a slightly different phobia than the masked slashers that you'd get in the back half of the 70s and throughout the 80s.
Yeah, it predates Halloween by 4 years and Friday the 13th by 6. And of course, the mask doesn't come into play in the first Friday the 13th because, spoilers, Jason's not the killer in Friday the 13th, part 1. So...
All right, Ghostface, that's enough. Slasher trivia.
Yeah, well, you know, I figured it was warranted.
But was a second remake of Black Christmas warranted? We shall see.
Yeah, we shall indeed. Matt, how about you take our listeners through a synopsis?
We open with a sort of intriguing, sort of visually abstract sequence of images. There's like a roaring fire. You can hear screams. I think that this is that you see the bust of... Is it Colin Hawthorne or
Calvin?
Calvin Hawthorne mixed in there at some point. It's images dissolving into images. It's like, am I watching like a frat house apocalypse now? What is this? And then like the flames. It's a neat, cheeky little dissolve where then the camera pulls out and it's a burning Yule log. And, you know, someone's got a roaring fireplace. It's Christmas Eve or thereabouts.
Yeah. And what we thought was screaming is actually just some sorority girls yelling and horseplay and whatnot.
There's a girl walking home alone. She starts getting ominous text messages. She thinks that it's from a guy walking several paces behind her who's on his phone.
Gives her a really like eerie look at one point.
Yeah, it's a look that I recognize because this is an experience I think that men and women sharing otherwise deserted streets at night have to have, where like you as a dude want to somehow signal to the other party that you're not a threat to them,
right?
Whether that involves crossing the street or like whatever else. And he is like, it is a sinister expression that he makes, but I think that he knows that she thinks that he's up to no good, and he like doesn't know what to do about that. That's how I read it looking back.
Yeah.
And he, yeah, misses a lot of those tricks.
Yeah, as opposed to making pretty serious eye contact.
Right. So the texting culminates in her attacker-to-be saying, "What does a sorority girl and a Christmas ham have in common? They both squeal before they die." Soon enough, she's murdered in front of a sorority house. She's banging on the door. "Let me in, let me in." The door opens and a masked figure emerges. At this point, we have every right to assume the same one who has been tormenting her via the phone and who also chased her up to the doorstep, masked and robed, I should say, very eyes wide shut. And then she is dispatched with an icicle. And as she's dying, she's flailing in the snow and makes a snow angel. So he calls her a Christmas ham, then kills her with an icicle. And then her death throes produce a snow angel. It's pretty relentless Christmas theming right off the bat. And if you're a Grinch like me, you're already kind of a little over it at that point. But the movie actually doesn't have that much Christmassy murder business in it. There's like one or two shout outs to the original. A couple deaths are repurposed and regurgitated that are Christmas themed. But for the most part, the movie gets all that junk out of its system right away, for good or ill. I'm not sure. You be the judge.
So this girl and the sorority from which she has come are not the primary focus of the film. There is another sorority chock full of characters, most of whom, as you may expect, will eventually die. But the main character, such as there is one, is named Riley, and she is a survivor of sexual assault. This isn't like volunteered immediately, but it comes out relatively quickly, sort of in drips and drabs.
Yeah, people bring it up kind of all the time, actually, like right in front of her, as though she weren't there. It's a little off-putting, and they keep talking about it euphemistically. The phrase that comes up is, remember what happened to Riley? Like, what happened to Riley? I feel like I heard those words half a dozen times in the first act or so. And then eventually the word rape is used, and it comes up at a kind of key juncture. So it's not like the movie's tiptoeing around it, but that was a little odd.
Yeah, it was a bit strange. She has several sorority sisters of varying degrees of prominence. There's Chris, who is sort of a firebrand radical who's successfully petitioned to have this bust of the college's founder removed from whatever building it was in because he was a piece of shit, basically. Racist, sexist, etc. The line was, he owned slaves in the North, which was pretty funny. She's also circulating a petition to try and have Professor Cary Elwes,
mm-hmm.
Gelson, I think is his character's name.
Professor Elwes will do fine for our purposes, right. I think.
Trying to get him removed because his curriculum, he's a literature professor, his curriculum is like exclusively white male authors. There's a scene in a lecture hall where he pulls this like bait and switch where there's this long drawn out quotation about women's place in the world and women's use of language, and it's all created by men and so forth.
Yeah, the words that women use to criticize the patriarchy were gifted to them by men, basically. And it's a take. It's maybe not completely without merit. I could, like, in the right hands, that could be sort of a you can't tear down the master's house with the master's tool kind of argument. But in the hands of Professor Elwes, it's basically just him whipping out his dick in a lecture hall. And so he calls on Riley, even though she did not raise her hand when he asked the class, you know, what do you think this author is trying to say? So he's singling her out. And she says, well, I think that he's, you know, doing such and such. And he says, aha! Why do you assume that? I'm not going to do my Professor Elwes impersonation the entire review, but he's really laying it on thick, the kind of effete British.
He's having himself a good time.
Yes. And he says, aha! Why do you assume the author is male? And I probably sound like a cartoon owl or something, but I'm telling you, that's the voice that he does. And
pretty much.
So as soon as he does this gotcha, where it was written by a woman, I was like, oh no, don't. And then he starts writing the name on the board, C-A-M-I, and Jim heard me under my breath go, Camille Paglia. And it was, sure enough, that's the name that emerges. That's his ace in the hole, you know, is that it was a female anti-feminist who was espousing these viewpoints. And it's, anyway, we may or may not get to that later on, but that's sort of, I don't know, it's introducing him, parroting Camille Paglia is, it's funny. It's a little more literary than I would have expected from a movie like this. I really didn't know what to expect of this movie. I think Jim had much more concrete expectations because he watched the full trailer, and I can all but guarantee that we're going to hear about that after the break.
Oh, so, yeah.
More on that later.
Yeah. So just rounding out the cast of characters, another one of Riley's sorority sisters is named Marty. She has a boyfriend who she just refers to as Smoosh most of the time. What was his actual name? Do you remember?
I don't.
Okay, well, we'll just call him Smoosh.
Yeah, I mean, I could look it up, but I think one appellation is plenty for that character.
Nate, maybe?
Yeah, quite. He looks like a Nate.
Anyway, maybe a Nathan. I'm pretty sure we hear Smoosh more than his actual name over the course of the film. So Smoosh is fine.
And he ends up getting smooshed. Spoiler alert. So.
And then there's Helena, who is Riley's little, for those of you conversant in fraternity and sorority slang.
Yuck.
And Jessie is the final one who's, I don't know, she kind of fits like the Ditz archetype a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, to the extent that any of them do. And none of them quite get pigeonholed that way, which is welcome. But yeah. It's not like a Zombieland double tap situation.
Oh, Jesus.
Where they're just a complete airhead caricature.
So, I don't know, the first, like, half of this movie is a little bit shapeless. There's a lot of, like, this girl's going home, and then she, like, falls off the radar, and nobody realizes it right away because it's time for winter break.
Yeah, I mean, peripheral sorority sisters start dropping like flies, but in the margins of the movie in such a way that most of the main cast are not even cognizant of it. Riley is a little quicker on the uptake than some of her sisters, but even that takes some time. Really, most of the preamble has to do with Riley's history with, was it Brian. Who attacked her?
President of this fucking fraternity.
Yeah, so it's to do with her trauma and her not wanting to. They're putting on this like Christmas pageant, this like Rockettes kind of thing, where unbeknownst to us, this took me by surprise, which I thought was a nice touch. They are planning to do a kind of subversive Christmas song calling out the rape culture on campus and sort of holding these frat boys' feet to the fire. And Riley has like choreographed the dance but doesn't want to be up there on stage because she knows that her rapist is going to be in attendance. But she ends up going through with it because one of the other girls, whose name escapes me,
Helena,
drinks to excess or is maybe roofied, hard to say, and Riley rescues her from a very unpleasant situation with one of Brian's mates or bros.
So Riley steps in and they start doing the routine, and it starts out very stock, suggestive girls in tight Christmas outfits. Mm-hmm.
Santa baby routine.
Yeah. And Riley spots Brian in the crowd and kind of locks up. But then once the song starts progressing into the more subversive, hey, call out rape culture lyrics. This is all redone lyrics to Up on the Housetop, if anyone's wondering.
Yeah, up in the frat house, click, 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 you slipped me a roofie and then you're a dick. That's the mic drop at the
yeah,
end
that
of the
was,
song.
Yeah, pretty much. Once it starts getting into the attack mode, I guess, she sort of recovers herself.
At one point, someone in the crowd, one of the frat boys, throws a paper airplane at them. It's like, who does that anymore? Like, I thought that they're going to start like a cafeteria food fight next. That's, you know, come on. I thought they were going to get like egged and tomatoed.
Yeah.
Reminded me of Danny DeVito in Batman Returns being like, who brings rotten produce to a rally? Or like whatever he says when he's hiding behind his umbrella.
Right.
So they're like hurling cabbage at him.
So they finish their mic drop and they run off stage and they're getting a bunch of stuff thrown at them, but they don't care.
And this is when I believe the word rape comes up for the first time, because Riley is feeling kind of jubilant and says maybe he'll think twice before he rapes another girl, something like that.
Something to that effect, yeah. It's around this time, it's like as they're leaving the party, that Riley and crew run into this guy, Landon, who's kind of this nebbishy, nerdy guy who's been clearly crushing on her at the coffee shop where she works, but has never gotten up the gumption to talk to her, really.
Classic beta male.
And so finally approaches her and they end up hanging out and hitting it off. She invites him, or more accurately Chris invites him, and Riley consents to their orphans dinner, you know, for people who are staying over Christmas break, staying on campus or near campus. So he's on the way for that the next day.
Prior to this, not immediately, but it's before the performance that they put on, Riley was, it's when she intercedes between, do you remember the name of the other rapist? Brian's
Phil.
Buddy? Phil. It's when she intercedes between Phil and his intended victim. When she's poking around the frat house looking for her, she sees some kind of hazing ritual, basically spying through a keyhole. watching a bunch of hooded frat boys sort of standing in a vigil around the bust of the founder of the college, his bust having been removed from a public space, like a campus library or something, for him being capital P problematic, as we discussed earlier.
I would just like to point out, as an ex-Latin scholar...
What do they keep saying? Fraternitas fratrum or something like that?
Yeah, which just means fraternity brothers.
Yeah, right. Me not being a student of Latin, heard that as like brotherly bros. Sounds like massively redundant.
Yeah, it's very silly.
Uh-huh.
Also, it's fraternitas. Like, I don't know, you're Midwesting it, you're Michiganing it. Like, fraternitas fratrum. if you're gonna try and like come up with an ominous sounding slogan in Latin, lean into it. Don't fucking just rattle it off in the lamest possible. I don't know.
I expected better of Professor Elwes. Honestly, he seems so posh and erudite, but then you know.
But
just...
wait, we're not supposed to know that he's involved yet.
Wow.
Well, once again, spoiler alert: the over the top.
Prancing,
misogynistic.
Mincing, misogynist, like gleefully misogynistic.
Professor is totally in on it.
Yeah, right.
So, anyway, yeah, Riley spots this ritual. So, something weird going on. But yeah, at first, we just figure it's like fucking fraternities, man.
Yeah, so, thank you, sir. May I have another? That kind of thing.
Right.
So, like I said, she's a little quicker on the uptake than most of the other characters by virtue of being the protagonist. She starts getting creepy texts through an app called Yip Yap.
Yeah, as opposed to Yik Yak, I guess.
Is that okay? See, that sounds equally made up to me because I'm out of touch. But
yeah, no, that was. I feel like Yik Yak was a thing a couple of years ago or something. It's basically just another fucking texting app for the youths, I guess.
You know, a bunch of spooky rhyming messages about how, I wonder if you'll put up a fight, keep guessing, maybe you'll get it right, because she's like, Landon? Who is this? You know, that kind of thing. She goes to campus security with her concerns after one of her sorority sisters doesn't show up at her family's place when she goes home for the holidays. We know that she's been offed. And the scene with the campus security goon sitting behind his desk eating a very unappetizing looking sandwich. There's like a shot of him like very laboriously squeezing out a mustard packet with this kind of...
I think it was mayo.
It was
made
mayo.
It even more disgusting.
No, my brain retconned it to be a little less vile. I'm not big on white condiments in general. Your mayos and ranches and sour creams and things. And apparently neither are the filmmakers, because that sandwich was dire. Anyway, this whole interaction plays out very much like the average... Yeah, it's supposed to echo her attempts to report her rapist, which fell on deaf ears some years previously. And so it's sort of a doubly unpleasant experience for her, having her concerns be written off because she's been there before in one form or another.
Yeah. Nevertheless, she, like, twists the guy's arm and gets him to go out to the frat house. And basically all he does is, like, knocks on the door. Nobody answers. They're like, well, nobody's home. She doesn't turn up in another 24 hours. Give me a call. You want her lift home? Okay, bye.
Yeah, that mayo sandwich isn't going to get any colder. And she proceeds to poke around a little bit after he leaves. She's looking in a window and gets jump scared from behind. It's this movie's lamest jump scare in the book, really. It's the classic, like, oh, sorry, didn't mean to startle you jump scare, where Professor Elwes comes up behind her and they both kind of jump scare each other, and he drops some papers that he was holding. She stoops down to pick them up and sees what is clearly a hit list. It's like names of women on campus, some of which have little X's next to them. And there's not a whole lot of ways to read that. I mean, it would be sinister even if there hadn't been one or more disappearances up to this point. And he then proceeds to insinuate a variety of threats. Chief among them, he not so subtly threatens a defamation suit because footage of their performance the other night has gone up online. And it ends with her saying the word rape as she goes off camera. I don't know. The video is going semi-viral and he wants it taken down in no uncertain terms.
Yeah. So she goes back to the sorority house where they're prepping dinner, and she starts getting into it with Chris, who's the one who posted the video, saying, like, you know, we're not all like you. We don't all want to be like you. We don't want to have to fight with everyone all the time. And they kind of go back and forth. Meanwhile,
Smoosh leaves in a huff.
Yeah,
at one
Smoosh
point.
Gets pissy all of a sudden, like, not all men.
Yeah, he says in order the phrases, words and phrases, not all men. And then he tells his girlfriend to calm down. And then as she slams the door in his face, he says, oh, you're being hysterical. You can like barely hear it. But it's like, yeah, bingo.
That's
all of them.
That's it.
He's like, yeah, no, it's like seeing the coins fall out of the slot machine when you hit a jackpot. It's just every single fucking one of them. And the fact that he calls her hysterical, like on his way out the door, just kind of slayed me a little bit. So the argument between the sisters continues to play out. One of them, unbeknownst to the others, has already been murdered in the attic. This is one of the kills that's lifted from the original movie. It's the classic killer lurking in the dark, and she's like plugging in Christmas lights. And then the, I don't know, we've seen a bunch of movies this year that do variations on, I don't know what to call it. Like any movie we've seen with like a motion activated light, like the new Halloween did this, the fucking
Countdown.
That's it. Jesus Christ. Countdown did it. And here it's flickering Christmas lights. She's plugging in strings of Christmas lights, trying to find one without a bad bulb in it. And then she gets got.
Even up to this point, there still hasn't been like a lot of tension or suspense really that I've felt. It's just kind of like, oh, okay, yep, somebody died. Got it. But then partway into the next scene, it's like a switch flips. And all of a sudden, guy in a robe and a mask just like appears and starts shooting at them with arrows.
Right, and it caught me by surprise in mostly a good way, because Smoosh, or whoever, has like just left.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like he walked out the door, put on a robe, and then came back in firing on all cylinders, which is, turns out to not be the case. But it's like there's almost like enough time has not elapsed for him to have made it more than a couple dozen yards from the house, probably less.
Yeah.
And so you're not expecting the shit to hit the fan at that exact moment. But yeah, no, I mean, they are besieged by cultists who shoot at them with arrows, just one at first, and then others start to emerge from the woodwork.
They manage to kill some of them, not before Smoosh returns, starts feeling his wild oats, I guess, and basically challenges the cultists, like, come at me, bro, and gets arrowed in the face. Because he takes it as his responsibility. Somebody's going to hurt my girl. I'm going to go get killed, I guess.
Yeah, this is shortly after him complaining about a migraine.
Yes.
And we hear this ringing effect in the mix, like when a bomb goes off next to you in a war movie.
Yeah. So Marty gets wounded. They hide in a closet for a little while. There's a fight in the kitchen. There's this scene in the trailer where Chris is like tiptoeing through the kitchen, and then we see like feet on the counter. It's at this time. They kill that guy. They take off his mask and find out it's the pledge that Riley saw earlier getting ritualed.
Yeah, it's while they're messing around with his corpse and removing his mask and what have you that they... Like, there's this black ichor all over him, and consequently all over them. Yeah, not blood, crucially. And this is not the first time that we've seen this tarry, gooey, whatever it is, around town. There was some on the door when she was spying on the frat boys, and there was some on a cat's paw earlier. It was kind of tracking it around the house.
And it's also the same shit that you can see coming out of the eyes of the bust during the ritual. So
of the founder, yeah, yes. Right. Oh, and the campus security guy shows up and gets promptly murdered.
Well, yeah, but that's in the other sorority house.
But yeah, but it happens. It's intercut with, right? No, but you're right. I'd forgotten that detail. There are other sorority houses that are being similarly besieged.
Yeah, it's the one where the first girl to die in the movie came from.
Right. So. He shows up, incidentally, and finds a bunch of sisters we've never met stabbing the shit out of a dude, like, in the foyer. And I was afraid that that was going to turn into a... Because he says, like, all right, everybody, hands up. He's got his gun drawn and everything. And he then gets an arrow to the, I think, base of his neck, which spares us the, I thought, obligatory, all right, you girls are coming with me.
Yeah.
You know, your reign of terror ends now. Leave those poor cultists alone.
Right.
But thankfully, the movie sidesteps that annoyance.
As Chris and Riley and Marty are trying to get out of the house, Marty also gets killed. She has kind of a Russell Crowe in L.A. Confidential moment where she, like, goes down, but then she's not dead and, like, stabs the guy in the leg. Spoilers for L.A. Confidential, I guess. But in the end, she does die, and Riley and Chris successfully make it out to Smoosh's car, where they drive off. Chris wants to go to the cops. Riley says...
Riley is connecting way more dots than a person could reasonably be expected to connect in this situation.
Yeah, she's basically like, yep, it's a cult. the guys trying to kill us aren't human anymore. That's why they don't bleed blood. The bust is responsible. We have to go destroy it. And Chris is basically like, what? You're insane. Riley doesn't want to go to the cops because, you know, she doesn't think the cops will do anything based on her prior experience with her assault. And so she gets Chris to pull over and kind of runs off on her own to the frat house.
She recruits, what's his name?
Landon.
Yes, who I had expected up until this point to be in on the scheme. It'd be like a secret initiate, and that he was going to be like a wolves in sheep clothing kind of character. But here he proves himself to actually be a quote-unquote ally. There's this kind of farcical sequence where he goes into the frat house and stages a diversion, like trashes the joint, and very meekly starts proclaiming that they've been Zeta'd.
Like you're like, not a Zeta.
Yeah, like it's a frat house prank war thing. Yeah.
Meanwhile... Riley is going through the house looking for her sorority sister, Helena, who is one of the ones who disappeared and who she believes might still be alive. Turns out she is, and unties her successfully, but then we get Helena's heel turn instead of Landon's. Helena was in on it the whole time, and Riley gets knocked out. And when she comes to, she sees that Landon is getting the black tar treatment, and there's Professor Elwes and Rapist Brian and other Rapist Phil and all the guys in their robes. And Professor Elwes gets his big
expository monologue
villain speech. Yeah, along with an assist from Brian.
I guess if you have to have the villain lecture the audience, they might as well be a professor, like a professional lecturer, because he's obviously very adept at that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of women's proper place, and Calvin Hawthorne, before he died, he was an expert in black magic, and he knew that someday women might get out of control, and so he set up this ritual that could create an army of young men who would turn the tide, and et cetera, et cetera.
Because this is a prestigious university, and so when these boys graduate, they are going to go on to be congressmen and hotshot lawyers and all manner of
titans
prominent
of industry. Yeah, right. Yeah. Meanwhile, Brian is saying all sorts of reprehensible shit specifically directed at Riley about, like, I'm gonna make you kneel, bitch, and all this stuff. Finally, he's like, are you going to kneel to the king? And then this big hulking cultist with a mask on walks through the doors, and like, okay, so who's this gonna be? And it turns out that when he's talking about the king, he's still referring to himself.
Uh-huh.
So, like, that whole sequence is composed weirdly.
Yes, because he gets this big villain entrance, this brute.
And we never even see the dude's face,
no,
I don't think.
No, couldn't matter less.
Yeah, he ends up breaking Helena's neck in order to show how committed they are. And she's, of course, saying, like, I did everything I was supposed to. So she's fucking dead. Riley feigns submission for a hot second just so she can get loose and like spring toward the altar where all the items that were used to, they're like talismans that sick the drones on various women. And she like grabs a sharp object basically and scratches Brian in the face. And it's around this time where Chris shows up, having picked up all the sorority sisters from the other sorority, and they just start kicking wholesale ass. And there's a melee. They start out strong, and then it looks like the cultists are kind of getting the upper hand, but Riley gets loose, and she picks up the bust, and Professor Elwes pleads with her not to do anything crazy, and, you know, if
women are inextricably need men, linked and if you, to men, yeah.
Yeah, if you break us, you only break yourselves. He says, we will never be broken, and then smashes the bust. This frees, apparently only Landon. I mean, like, presumably anybody who's been who's been hypnotized by this could be freed, but I guess apparently all the other guys are on board.
Yeah, I guess they didn't. No one else needed the hive mind element. They were already in touch with their inner alpha. That's a line. That's why I called Landon a beta male earlier. Not usually in my vocabulary, I assure you.
Yeah.
It's because when he's absorbed into the cult, Brian, I think, says something about how the founder has put him in touch with his inner alpha.
Right, that's what the, apparently the bust has the power to emit, like, ultrasonic waves.
Which is where the shell shock ringing noise was coming from. It's also the same reason that Smoosh
was having a migraine.
Yeah, evolved into Alpha Smoosh right before he became Smooshed.
Anyway, Landon and the surviving sisters all book it for the exits. Riley grabs some kind of like oil lamp or something and hurls it at Professor Elwes's feet and lights him on fire, which ends up lighting the whole place on fire.
Yeah, and then they bar the doors with oars paddles or something.
Fraternity paddles. And then they're outside just watching the place burn. And the final shot was kind of confusing because it's like Riley is,
it's an we've won but at what cost face, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
Was that your take as well? That she looks a little, it's a close up of Riley and she looks, it's a look of consternation that kind of comes over her.
Well, it's like I didn't know how to read it. Like, right. I saw that. Is there going to be like another scene where they didn't get everybody or something? Like, that's the only reason that face would have made any sense to me. Not like at what cost have we won, but we haven't actually won. This isn't over.
Well, in a societal sense, well, I suppose it isn't.
I mean,
but
sure, but it's, that face conveys to me that in like the immediate practical sense, that's what was meant. And
yeah,
that doesn't make any sense because that is literally the last shot, with the exception of a mid-credits sting of their sorority house cat licking up some more of the black stuff and, you know, engaging with its inner alpha, I guess.
Cats are already all in touch with their inner alpha. That's a known fact. They're all little douchebags. It's possible that Riley is just considering the consequences of having just torched a bunch of very promising young men, or that at least that's how it's going to be read by a good many people. So,
perhaps.
But you really have to kind of read between the lines to find that.
Yeah.
And a movie is otherwise very on the nose about most of its messaging, even to a kind of soapbox degree at times. And so it was odd to end on a note of ambiguity.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's Black Christmas. So we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
This school has 200 years of history. Many sacrifices have been made to keep our traditions alive.
You're all insane.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break, to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I'm tired of hiding. I'm tired of running. Go, 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 go!
Ho, 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 bitch. You mess with the wrong sisters.
are back. So the first thing I want to complain about, and Matt alluded to this earlier, but the trailer for this movie is the most spoilery thing I have ever seen. I didn't even realize that apparently I was not the only person to feel this way. Apparently there was widespread, presumably online, backlash against the trailer because of how spoilery it is. I wasn't really in the loop on that. I just remember I only saw the trailer one time. I'm like, oh, that's the whole movie. And people say that a lot about various trailers that are long and have lots of plot details in them. But literally, like, it gives away that there's a cult and there's some supernatural stuff going on. It gives away that Professor Elwes is in it, which is not really a surprise, but that's still something you're supposed to, you know, keep under wraps.
Yeah, and we're not especially spoiler averse here on the Shock Doctors podcast. I mean, that's kind of the whole conceit of the first half of every episode, is that we just, you know, it's just a parade of spoilers, and we routinely spoil the shit out of old movies like LA Confidential or whatever else. You know, I generally find that most good movies, sturdy, well-made movies, don't actually hinge on twists. You know, that if you know the twist going in and that ruins the movie, that means that that was the only thing the movie had going for it.
Right.
Which is not really a laudable quality.
But that all being said, the fact that
it is egregious.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because number one, this whole cult thing is a new addition for the remake. As yes. we've said, the original is just straight up about one murderer killing college girls in a sorority house. Like, that's the whole thing. And if the trailer had been a little, you know, played its cards a little closer to the vest, we could have gone in assuming that this one would be just the same, and that all this cult stuff could have been a surprise. I don't know exactly how the plot of the first remake plays out, but I'm inclined to believe it's similar to the original. So once again, it'd be just another reason this stuff could have come out a little more out of left field.
Yeah, maybe that was their fear, is that they didn't want people to think that it was just a second remake.
Right.
Of Black Christmas, a third Black Christmas movie. Then somebody had the bright idea to be like, well, we got to differentiate it. We got to show them that this is a different kettle of fish. But they went and spilled the whole damn kettle just all over the floor.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just see all the fish flopping around, and it's a fucking mess. The trailer's a mess. It's got one bewildering moment in it where it's the unmasking scene with the dead frat boy on the floor of the sorority house. They peel off the mask and his head is a bust. It's like a marble
face.
Yeah.
And that's not in the movie at all. I don't know if they had a different scene, or that scene played out completely differently originally, and then they shot an alternative that made it into the theatrical cut. Or if that was like a sloppy trailer edit to like cut back on spoilers.
Which is nonsense because of the way the whole rest of the trailer is designed. Yeah, it'd be very weird for that trailer specifically to attempt any form of obfuscation whatsoever, just because it is really letting it all hang out spoiler wise.
Yeah.
If there was ever a version of this movie where the founder's telepathy
conjured golems.
Or like literally transmogrified his acolytes into marble men or like plaster men,
stone men.
I'm glad that that version of the movie never came to light, because that would have been ludicrous. But
I don't know, it might have been fun though.
Maybe go big or go home, I guess.
So yeah, the trailer's a problem, and like I said multiple times during the synopsis, this movie has pacing issues. And it's always a bad sign when a 92-minute film has pacing issues, because typically it shouldn't be that hard to do. But literally, like, the first half of this movie, it just seems to be kind of lurching aimlessly from one suspense-free murder sequence to the next. Like, okay, the first girl who gets killed, there's a little bit of suspense. Fine. She's scrambling to, like, get inside a house, any house, get away from this guy. But the next murder that happens features a character from Riley's sorority whose name I absolutely don't remember. It might have been Franny.
Was it Diva Cup?
Yeah, his diva cup girl.
Her first line, indeed, I think the first line after the title drop, so after the preliminary murder with the icicle and the snow angel and everything, is she bursts into Riley's room and says, "I have a final in 10 minutes and I can't find my diva cup anywhere," which... Yeah, no, I mean, and that's her whole character is kind of like a straw feminist almost, but not in like a mean-spirited mocking way. When I first heard that line, I saw two paths diverging in front of me. on one timeline, I was watching a really like kind of nasty takedown of like campus SJWs, and on the other timeline, I was watching something that was aspiring to be woke. And at that moment, it was like a coin toss. I genuinely had no idea where this Diva Cup character was going to take me. Turns out it was the latter,
yeah,
mercifully. But yeah, her character is basically a non-entity outside of those signifiers of straw feminism.
Yeah, and her death sequence is just like she's in the sorority house by herself. Here's the cat making noises, and it's like looking in every room.
Yeah, it's a static shot,
like super wide.
Yeah, it's an homage, a pretty flagrant homage to a scene in Exorcist 3. And I knew that it was an Exorcist 3 thing even before it ends in exactly the same way, with a sudden zoom and a scare cord as a robed figure emerges from the left side of the frame.
I don't think there was even a zoom. I think the guy just like kind of charges and then there's a cut.
I would stake my life on there being a zoom, but yeah.
I think maybe you were just summoning up Exorcist 3 and wanted it to be that. I don't know.
Maybe not my life, because this movie has clearly been meddled with, if the dead bust boy in the trailer is any indication. So by the time it reaches home video, who knows, there might not be a zoom. Gonna Mandela effect me.
Yeah, right.
Bastards.
So yeah, that one's just kind of listless. Even Jesse getting Christmas light murdered in the attic, there's a little more suspense there. But it's really just like, okay, how many strings of lights is she gonna have to plug in before the guy is lit up sitting right next to her in the dark?
Yeah, and that would have been a more effective scene if the attacker had come from anywhere other than the dark space behind her where you know that he's lurking. I mean, shit, it's about a murderous cult. There could have been more than one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the lights could have come on and you see him there, and then like she gets it from behind or something. Because I don't think that the movie was trying to... You know, like the characters are surprised when they find out that there's more than one maniac out to get them, but I don't think we're meant to be at that point. It's pretty apparent that...
Well, the trailer certainly didn't try to hide it.
No, I suppose not.
But yeah, I guess just to finish off the point, there's no drive to the movie in at least the first half, maybe even the first like 60%. And then it's literally like a switch flips as the first arrow flies, and all of a sudden they're under attack from all sides.
And then all of a sudden it starts to feel more like You're Next or something of that ilk.
Or Ready or Not.
Yeah, Ready or Not is the other one that I kept thinking of. Yeah, it's that sort of Home Alone for grown-ups kind of feeling where, you know, it's about like a plucky, resourceful character kind of having to get creative and turn the tables on their attackers. I mean, Home Alone for grown-ups is weird because Home Alone is just straw dogs for kids. But so it's straw dogs for kids for grown-ups, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Anytime a movie like this reminds me more of Home Alone than of straw dogs, it means that there's like some bite missing.
Yeah,
even like the black Icarus goo that comes out of them felt like a little PG-13. Like they're trying to avoid the movie becoming a bloodbath, but there's more than enough F-bombs to give it an R rating anyway, so I don't think that was actually a consideration. It just felt, and that was part of why it felt a little toothless to me at times.
Yeah,
is that it's hard to when it looks like they've just got crude smear it all over their hands and faces. It just doesn't feel like a slasher movie.
Right.
At that point, it's like they're doing battle with, like she says, they're not human anymore. Reminded me of when I was a little kid and my mom found me playing the first Halo game in what, 2001, 2?
Yeah.
A little unsettling, and I was like, "No, see, they bleed green and purple. It's okay. It's not violent in the same way." You know?
Just don't look at when the humans die.
Yeah, right. Well.
But yeah, no, and it's like standards and practices on, you know, like Cartoon Network back in the day. Cartoons could have all sorts of like anti-alien, anti-robot violence because there's no blood.
Right. That's what it is. It's like they're just bleeding oil, like they're killing robots.
Yeah, but a human gets a little cut on their arm and they're on thin ice.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that in this movie.
On the subject of, I guess, the movie not having the kind of bite that I maybe wanted it to have, the final fracas, the brouhaha in the frat house, when Chris and the other survivors come charging in with their makeshift weapons, it turns into like this slow motion melee where, I don't know, I mean, I for some reason during that brawl, I started thinking about, I mean, I've said it over and over again on this podcast, and it's maybe the only true thing that you can say about art in general and film in specific. Execution is everything.
Okay.
I was thinking about the ending of Suspiria and how like artful and alarming it was when all the heads started exploding. I just wanted a little bit more, because this movie is directed with a fair deal of panache at times, more than I expected to see, at least initially, before I really knew what to make of this movie, because I had not seen the trailer that Jim had seen.
Yeah.
I'd seen like 5, 10, 15 second ads that played in front of my YouTube videos, and so I expected it just to be a straightforward remake of Black Christmas, just a sort of by-the-numbers slasher thing. But when the time came for all of these frat boy cultists to get their comeuppance, I wanted, I guess, something a little more highbrow. That's why I was thinking of the Suspiria remake from last year, which is probably my favorite horror movie of last year. Mm-hmm. Up there with my favorite movies across all genres that came out in 2018. I wanted Suspiria, but what I got was like a community theater 300. It felt like
I was gonna say it is a little Snyder-y. Like, yeah. it doesn't do the speed up slow down thing, but the rest of it, it's very, yes, Snyder-y.
Yeah.
Release the Snyder cut of Black Christmas.
We know it exists, Warner Brothers.
Snyder tweeted about it. He showed us film canisters. It's gotta be real. Sorry, I've seen so many fucking movieweb.com fucking headlines about the Snyder Cut. It just had to come out somewhere.
Well, you never know. A 3.5-hour version of Black Christmas might have fixed those pacing issues.
Yes, by making them worse.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, please proceed.
Well, no, I mean, that's the long and the short of it, at least as it concerns that scene. I just thought that the end of this movie, it still feels campy. And I didn't want it to, because when Cary Elwes invokes the idea of all of these Brock Turners going out into the world and becoming important, powerful, influential people, that's a scary notion. This is the scariest thing in the whole movie. And then it just turns into this Battle of Thermopylae on a shoestring budget kind of affair. And
right.
that was unfortunate, I think. And she like smashes the bust and... you know, they
misogyny's
all...
over, you guys.
Yeah, it just turns into like that everything to do with the bust being magical is way too Indiana Jones for me. I could not follow the movie as far as it wanted me to go in that department, and just the whole mind control element, I feel, muddies the water too much. I just wanted the guys in the cult, in the frat, to have accountability, to be like culpable for their actions, and having the ghost of the guy who founded the college be orchestrating things to that extent. It's one thing if they're like taking orders from him, but the idea that he's actually hijacking their bodies is a bridge too far, because if they're going to get torched, I need to know that they were willing participants in all of this bedlam. And then, clearly they were, but why muddy the water at all? You know?
Well, yeah. Cause they end up, like I said, they basically end up walking that back anyway when the bust gets smashed and the only guy who seems to like come to his senses and not keep trying to murder these women is Landon.
Right.
Like, all the guys who are actually in the frat who ended up getting possessed and then unpossessed, they're still like, rah! you know, it's okay, so why is all of this hullabaloo even fucking necessary? It's not like the possession has given them superpowers or right. anything. It's not made them super strong or invulnerable to pain or being like stabbed with keys or whatever, which is a recurring thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just mind control, and it's unnecessary. And like you say, it muddies the waters sort of thematically.
I wanted the murderers to be more recognizably human pretty much across the board, even before it became apparent that they were all just kind of being puppeted by Hawthorne. The way that they go about the slashing, it was way too Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees for me. I mean, mm-hmm. the thing about Black Christmas, and part of what makes it a proto-slasher movie, is that the killer in it is unmistakably human. You never see his face. You see his eye at one point. So he's faceless in a sense, but you hear his voice more than once. He's not your typical silent masked slasher. In fact, I mean, the creepiest thing about the original Black Christmas is that the killer is never identified and the crime is never solved. So technically he could be in thrall to a long dead racist sexist, you know, who knows if that's your headcanon, you know, more power to you.
Headcanon.
Yeah. But right. That's a Shock Doctor's deep cut. We still got to get that on a mug or a shirt or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, they just plod around. They take their sweet time, these slashers, in a Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees kind of way. When I wanted, like, if one of them gets stabbed with, you know, a pair of keys or whatever else, I want to hear them grunt and be like, ah, you fucking bitch.
Right.
You know, like, I wanted more. I mentioned Ghostface at one point before the break. I wanted this to be closer to Scream in the sense that when you're wrestling with the killer, he's obviously working up a sweat.
Yeah.
And you like, and you can see him sweat. And if you hurt him, then you can see him bleed and you can see him limp. And it makes it feel like a more life or death struggle. Just watching them kind of pacing themselves and stomping around like automatons, it doesn't really feel like, an illustration of the practical reality of the kind of violence that actually befalls women, you know? And I feel like this movie is trying to evoke that, but it gets way too into the weeds with all the supernatural stuff.
Yeah.
I said before that it's directed with more panache than I expected. Once the trailers came up, I saw that it was a Sofia Takal joint who did a movie I like quite a bit called Always Shine. I don't think this one quite measures up to that. Did I mention Always Shine by name a couple in the Lighthouse episode? I talked about how two people going insane together movies run the risk of just
being persona,
being in the shadow of persona. Yeah, and The Lighthouse gets out of that shadow. Always Shine does not, but it still succeeds in being interesting. I think I talked about Queen of Earth. I didn't mention Always Shine. Always Shine is like another example of that trope.
Yeah.
But in any case, go check out Always Shine, I guess. No, but this movie is clearly directed by someone with like a proper filmmaking sensibility. I mean, The Exorcist 3 shout out is done well enough. If I hadn't seen Exorcist 3, I probably would have liked it a lot more. There's a lot of shots of leering gargoyles in the first half of this movie, which feels kind of arty in a way that I wasn't expecting, again, before I knew who made the damn thing. The Yule log transition at the very beginning, I already singled out for praise. Bringing Camille Paglia into the mix was, you know, more...
Camille Paglia.
Yeah, I mean, there's some... I will say this. Most cheap horror movies about college students being murdered do not appear to be made by people who went to college. And this one does. And that doesn't mean it's like a slam dunk or a masterpiece or anything. I actually have, you know, a lot of issues with it, but it is smart enough. It's also a little bit near the end of an SJW screed, which I have a high tolerance for, being a bleeding heart myself in more ways than not. But it's a movie that's turned a lot of people off, and not just because the marketing was a fucking total misfire.
Yeah. Not that this should in any way be held against the film, but it is one of those that inspired a negative ratings bomb on IMDb. It's got like a flat 3.0 out of 10 out of like 1,600 some votes up to this point. And like, I didn't love it. I might have liked it even a little bit less than Matt did, but I'd still say it's like a solid 5.
Yeah, for sure.
Certainly, to be a 3 on IMDb, you either have to be an utterly piece of shit movie, or you have to have made a bunch of pieces of shit real angry.
Yeah, you must have found your way into somebody's crosshairs.
Yeah. So, it did not deserve that, but that is what has happened to it.
Yeah, well, you know, we got a new Ghostbusters coming out.
Well, yeah, but this one is, like, avowedly going back to pre-Ghostbusters 16.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying.
So, yeah, this one will get, like, a 9.5 out of 10 on IMDb and get catapulted to, like, number 3 on the top 250, you know, way over the original.
I mean, I think that this movie knew that it was courting controversy, or else it wouldn't go for broke the way it does with some of its rhetoric. Like I said, in the first 20-odd minutes of this movie, the word rape doesn't even come up, and I thought that the movie was pulling punches a little bit. But then by the end, there's some very kind of high-flown language about, you know, when she smashes the bust, she says, "We'll never be broken." And that scene's got everything except for a riff on "Nevertheless, She Persisted." It's very,
yeah,
like, I don't know. I can see how people, even guys who aren't, like, frothing at the mouth sexists, might find that tedious or preachy. I, like I said, have a fairly high tolerance for it, but I think of a movie which I treasure, like Society, where the theme and the messaging are really bludgeoning you over the head, but the actual content of the movie keeps pace with it in a way. Like, that movie gets really outlandish near the end, really,
yes,
soaringly absurd in a way that, and I prefer that kind of packaging for like a soapbox movie, because it's like the movie, you know, it's big on message, but it's also big on thrills and spills and shocks and everything else. And this movie, like I said, it just turns into a kind of rinky-dink poor man's 300,
yeah,
at the end. And I wish, especially if they're going to lean into the supernatural black magic bullshit, get a little crazier with it. Maybe that looks like the cultists having statuesque heads under their hoods. I don't know. I mean, I poo-pooed the idea earlier, but it's possible that that would have, I don't know, a little bit of sugar helps the medicine go down, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at earlier. It's just basically the supernatural angle to the cult is extraneous. It's completely fucking extraneous,
yes,
to the movie. The only thing it does is put Landon under the spell.
For all of 4 minutes.
Yeah, and in that 4 minutes, it's not like the possession makes him do anything that he wouldn't normally have done. Other than, you know, like, stand idly by. But I mean, like, he doesn't torture a girl or, like, hurt Riley or whatever. That's typically what this kind of conflict is designed to do. Somebody who's fundamentally a good person falls under the sway of black magic, and then they're compelled to do things they wouldn't normally do that they would find abhorrent. It doesn't do that. And, again, he's the only one who appears to have really experienced any effect of the possession other than, oh, well, we bleed tar now.
Right.
So why even have bothered? Just have them all worshiping this dead college founder and his bust and going around murdering girls and just leave it at that.
Right. Just make them a bunch of fanatical fucking weirdos like they are in real life. You don't need, and I like the idea of an ultrasonic frequency that brings out a man's inner alpha, like what was starting to happen to Smoosh right before he took an arrow to the head.
But it happens twice.
Yeah, and I feel like that premise belongs in like a sci-fi horror movie. Maybe,
yeah,
it could be like a Mom and Dad kind of thing, the Nicolas,
yeah,
Cage movie where all of a sudden everyone with children goes berserk and starts trying to murder their kids. If you isolated the sound wave that turns everyone into a psycho Chad, that could be a horror movie but it's not as compatible with this sexist death cult on campus movie that with the story that this movie is trying to tell. You don't need both. In fact, you kind of, there isn't room for both, I think.
Yeah, Matt, let's write a movie and just call it Sexist Death Cult on Campus.
That'll be the that'll be like the Asylum Pictures version of Black Christmas, not that it's going to get one.
Yeah. No, that would just be called like Black Xmas.
Dark Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the movie has enough nice touches in it that I'm a little more charitably disposed towards it than you are, but not by a huge margin. And there, the nice touches that are there aren't enough to get me coming back for seconds, I don't think. I like how often the women resort to defending themselves with car keys. That feels true to life. And I like I like that the alibi for all of the frat boys is that they're all supposed to be off on a ski trip. That feels fittingly douchey.
Yeah.
And I could go on, but I'll spare you. I mean, it's an adequate movie, and I'm glad that it's not just another Black Christmas remake, but it doesn't stick the landing in a lot of ways. Still a Sofia Tikal fan, though.
Sure. Well, I think that's all we have for Black Christmas. So this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And keep an eye out for sexist murder cultists on campus. We'll see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Black Christmas official trailer HD, uploaded by Universal Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, January 12th, and oddly enough, we'll be watching another remake, this time of The Grudge. See you then.